Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hey, and welcome back. My name is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I'm back for round two with Rachel Balkovic. Rachel is the first female strength and conditioning coach in professional baseball. She's a former LSU softball player, and she's one of the most knowledgeable and passionate coaches that I've ever met. On this episode, we go into how to teach someone to focus on the process rather than the outcome, how to support others just enough so they can do it for themselves. We talk a lot about personal development and much, much more. Enjoy the show. Rachel, nice to have you back on the show.
Great to be back. I'm happy to be here.
Hell yeah. So I was telling you yesterday, as I was preparing for this, I always look back, like if I do two shows, I look back to see what we talked about before. And sometimes I'll even go back and listen to the show. And I remember just feeling so fired up at the end of our last one. And then looking at the questions, I was like, what the fuck? This is the simplest shit ever. And I was just getting really excited because I know that I've grown a ton since our last show, and I know you have as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to be here with you to see what we can discuss again.
Oh, who knows what's going to happen right now? I'm a little nervous, to be honest with you.
You should be. You should be. I'm going to grill you.
Okay.
So you spent a lot of time overseas last year.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the things that you can do with your time, how did you prioritize world travel?
To describe what you just said to people who don't know, I went to last year in the off season, a baseball off season, I went to Europe for a month with my boyfriend, and then I went to Asia for a month. And I mean, my boyfriend invited me on his trip, so that's why I went there. But the reason why I chose to go to Asia is, I think what you're getting at is, how did I choose that, or how did I prioritize where to go and what to do? And that was pretty simple. Like, I wanted to be so far out of my comfort zone, and I'm grinning like so wide right now because I was like, I was so scared out of my mind when I went to Laos. So yeah, that was just like, I saw a picture on Instagram literally, and I was like, where's that? And then when I looked it up, it was in Laos, and I kind of had heard of Laos, but I didn't even know where it was. And I looked it up, and I just looked at the airports, and they don't speak English. Like, there's not a lot of English there. It's getting a lot more. And so I was like, yeah, I'm going there. Like, I just had no idea where it was. No idea like anything about the country, and right. I was like, okay, that's where I'm gonna go, because I knew it was gonna stretch me the most. And then I looked for the most out of my comfort zone opportunity there. So I went to, once I decided to go there, which, by the way, I saw the picture on Instagram, bought the ticket that night to go to Laos. Nice, like, nice. Did not think too much about it, and then I started kind of letting everything else fall into place. So I started following Laos travel sites and whatnot, and found a school that teaches English to kids there, which I'll never do again. And I can explain that if you want. But so I found the school is in a small, small village called Phonsawat, which is not even on Google Maps. Like, you can't find it if you want to. And it was out of my comfort zone. I can tell you a couple of things that happened, but yeah, it was.
Yeah, before that, you keep bringing up this, I knew I wanted to get outside my comfort zone. What is that? Explain that.
I just am seeking constantly to, I guess, find, you know, there's intentional growth and there's unintentional growth. So you can, you know, it's not easy, but it's easy to stumble upon growth by, you go into an experience not knowing that it's going to be hard. It's way harder than you thought. And then you look back 6 months to a year to 5 years later, and you're like, that was the best thing ever. And I, you know, I'm so glad I went through that. Or that's unintentional, that's great. Okay. But there's also intentional growth where you're like, that scares the shit out of me, and I'm going to go do it anyway, and I'm going to do it to the max. And I guess that's the answer, is that I'm constantly seeking, like, what am I avoiding that I know I could grow from, and how can I do that? And so that's what I'm going to do. You know, like it's even more difficult to look at something that you're like, ooh, I'm afraid of that, and still take the step to go do it. And so that's what I'm seeking.
So yeah, give us a specific example of something that pushed you out there and what you got out of it.
I mean, like every minute of the time. Well, not every minute, but especially the first moments of, okay, I arrive in Laos and I had like booked an Airbnb. Like I was so afraid when I first got there. It was incredible. I got picked up by the people for the like school that I was going to be volunteering at. And it was like a 3-hour ride through the jungle. And when they picked me up, I was so jet lagged. I just fell asleep in the bus. And I woke up pitch black. They're like, okay, we're here. We get out. And there's like cows right outside the van. And I'm like, okay. They took us into the house. And of course, the pictures online for the house for the volunteers were much nicer than it actually was, which is fine. We go inside. He shows me like the bathroom. It's a squatting toilet. There's no shower. It's like bucket showers out of this giant vat of water that's just sitting still water. And I'm just like, I'm not showering the whole time. Like, here we go. Takes me to my room, which is on the second floor. It's basically a barn structure. And there's like wooden, you know, slats for the floor and the walls. Takes me upstairs. It's freezing cold. He's like, hey, this is your room. It was like a wooden cot with a thin, you know, pad on it under a mosquito net. And I was like, all right, like this is what I asked for. And I kept telling myself that, like, I was in panic mode. I was like, I can't stay here. There's absolutely no way. And I just panicked. Like somehow I was so tired because I was so messed up from the travel that I slept, woke up to like cowbells ringing right at sunrise. Freezing, absolutely freezing, because oh, wow. There's no, obviously no air heat, and just, yeah, so under a mosquito net. And I sat there for the first couple of days when I went to bed and I woke up. I just would sit there frozen. Like I just didn't move. I did not move for like an hour and a half to 2 hours the first morning. I just laid there uncomfortably in the bed and stared at the ceiling. And then, you know, over time, just like anything else, when you're in a growth type of experience, I realized how stupid I was for feeling scared, because that was the most peaceful, communal, like tribal, you know, community that I've ever been in, obviously. And I was probably much safer, not probably, for sure, much safer there in a lot of ways than I am in the United States. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, shooing goats out of the kitchen, like, animals are just, the animals roam free and interact with people there as if they're citizens of the wow. village. Just like every step of the way. I didn't shower for the first like couple of days because I was so, it's just so stupid. I was like so afraid that I was going to be, I don't know, infected by the water, which at some point you're just like, I don't have a choice. I have to drink water. I have to like have some kind of, some level of hygiene. You know, I like didn't, I mean, this is TMI, but for the sake of the podcast, like I didn't go number two for as long as possible because I was like,
something's going to climb up there.
Well, if you've never seen a squatting toilet, it's like just what it says. It's a squatting toilet. So you like stand over this toilet with your feet on either side and you just have to like do your business. And there's mosquitoes like flying around. Mm-hmm. So you're like swatting mosquitoes while you're trying to, oh, it's a mess. So every single thing was uncomfortable. But I quickly realized how, I mean, I left there. I, long story short, I, you know, went through being in Asia for a month and I flew straight to Los Angeles, and I had accidentally booked an Airbnb in a not so good part of Los Angeles. Gotcha. Just because I don't know LA that well. And I booked it in South Central LA. So anyway, I booked this Airbnb and I rolled up to my Airbnb and I was just like, okay, I'm in way more danger right now than I just was in the middle of a village in, right. in Laos, you know? So the dichotomy is just like, I felt so afraid to do all this stuff. I was outside of my comfort zone. By the time I left there, I didn't want to leave. And I just thought like, I never want to teach kids English ever again, because I'm like, no, stay exactly like this. Mm-hmm. Don't try to westernize your civilization, because you guys have it figured out and we're totally messed up.
Wow. That's super powerful. Yeah, one reason I like experiences like that, I've never been to any Asian countries, but places that are either third world or just not as developed, is I really, really quickly appreciate what I have at home more. Like just all of the small things that we take for granted, like four walls where air doesn't get through and heating and air conditioning and just all these tiny things that we don't even hardly ever think about.
No.
And it all, it, I think it just about immediately them every puts day. It in perspective.
I think about those people and their society and just that whole experience every single day of my life.
Wow. And how long were you there?
I was in the village for 3 weeks maybe. And then my sisters met me in Thailand after that. And we kind of did like the normal, you know, touristy kind of trip, I guess. But I mean, it's just what you just said brings it to me on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. I travel a lot with the team and we're in, you know, in hotels that are really nice hotels. And I like everyone complains about something at the hotel. And I hear that. And I'm just like, at one point I was going to the bathroom in at a squatting toilet where I was swatting mosquitoes away from my body. Or like even myself, perfect example. I turned on the water at the hotel and it was early morning and I guess it just takes a while for the water to heat up. And I was like waiting for the water. It was freezing cold and I had it on all the way hot. And I was just like, oh God, like this is taking forever to heat up my water in my nice hotel, in my nice, just like in a nice city, in a safe place. And I think about them all the time. I'm like, I'm so stupid. I'm so ungrateful. I'm such a baby. Like this is something that it's deeply affected me like in every step of my life. So
that's really cool. Yeah. And that's an incredibly valuable experience that it's left you reflecting on it for like you're still reflecting on it a year later.
I will for a long time.
And you appreciate everything that you have more. That's awesome. Yeah. Okay. So you just mentioned the team. Catch everybody up. Remind everybody who you work for before we get into this.
So I work for the Houston Astros and I'm there right now. I'm double A strength coach. So if that means nothing to you, that's fine. No one knows about minor league baseball, but basically there's the TV team, which is the Houston Astros based out of Houston, Texas. And then underneath that team, there's, I think we have 9 minor league teams. And so previously I was working as the Latin American coordinator, which is with like the babies that we just signed in the Dominican that are 16 years old. And now I've kind of flip-flopped. The organization put me at double A, which is the second highest minor league team, like so the second closest to being in Houston. So it's kind of like not even close to the end of their development, but much further along in their development in the minor league system. So that's who I'm working with right now.
Awesome.
Coming to the end.
So you're one of the most passionate coaches that I've ever met. And I assume that somewhere along the way, you've had some great mentors that have kind of given you some of that passion. What is one of, if not the biggest thing that you've learned from one of your coaches, and who was that?
Oh my gosh. I have like too many mentors to, like when you said the word mentors just now, the people that flash into my mind are actually my parents. And I'll just go with them if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like they're not coaching mentors, but they coached me. Like, and I think about that all the time, is that I'm a reflection of my parents in my coaching style. And if you've ever read, have you read Grit by chance?
Yes.
By Angela Duckworth. So if anyone's ever read Grit, she describes like the parenting matrix, which I'm not calling it the right thing, but basically it's a scale of being supportive and demanding. And when I read that book, I was like, it was like reading a story about my parents. I was like, what? How do they even know how to do this stuff?
Right.
Like they obviously didn't know Angela Duckworth's research. But I was like, wow, they literally like were extremely demanding of us, like so demanding, but also extremely supportive. Like they were never the parents that we get done with a game and they were like, how could you have made that error? You know, they never said anything to us about the performance. It was always hard work. Like they praised us for working hard and effort and sticking with something, being disciplined. And they did not care if we won the game, got the grade, whatever. Like if they saw us put in the work, they were happy about that. Mm-hmm. And so then that instilled values in me that are still present today. So I would say like shout out to Jim and Bonnie Balkovec, the best coaches I've ever had. And, you know, and then I probably naturally sought out mentors or then had mentors that like mirrored my parents as well. Mm-hmm. So like going to LSU and experiencing Coach Moffitt and Melissa Moore, they're like my parents. They're extremely demanding, but also extremely supportive of their athletes. And so those people at LSU, extremely, you know, good mentors of mine, but also just mirroring things that I had learned growing up. You know, I was a good fit there because of my parents, and they were like my parents.
Right. Do you feel like you were personally very performance driven and results driven in terms of did you put more weight on the effort and attitude and all of that kind of stuff, or more the winning and losing?
No, definitely effort.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, definitely effort. Just because probably, you know, when you're young, that's what you're praised for. And so you're going to, I mean, obviously the winning.
You're going to value that.
Yeah. If you're praised for that, you're going to value that. And you're going to put your effort into being disciplined and putting in the time and the work it takes. And so that you can get approval from, you know, your parents or your coaches or whatever. And then eventually then that becomes your value system that you just do. And so same thing now is that, like, it's almost irrelevant if I actually win, you know, in air quotes, whatever I'm doing, as long as the process was valuable and I learned something from it. And, you know, it's less important if I actually win. And then that's how I view coaching too, is that basically if an athlete works hard, I'm going to love them no matter if they're like, you know, in strength and conditioning context, no matter if they're super strong or powerful or they actually like achieve a goal, it's like if I see them put in the work and have intent behind their daily practice, then they've won me, you know, right. They won me over.
Right. So obviously not everyone was brought up like you, and a lot of people were praised for good grades or even punished for bad grades, mm-hmm. or they were praised for winning and scolded for losing or some version of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of the athletes that you come across have been brought up, raised, coached that way. How do you start to break through that barrier to teach them that kind of stuff?
So many athletes, so many people, you know, were brought up that way. And I think it's probably a relief, even though they don't consciously know, it's probably a relief for some of them to have somebody who's, you know, I get just as excited. I get just as excited when a guy tells me, hey, my back doesn't hurt when I'm squatting. And I like give them a hug,
right.
You know, like literally, I mean, it has happened this season where a guy comes to me, you know, the day after squatting heavy, and we've been working on a lot of like just process stuff, like not sexy, just lightweight technique stuff. And like, I'm thinking of a specific player came up to me the next day and he goes, Rachel, my ass is sore today. And I was like, oh, really? I was like, wait, is your back
ass?
Sore? Yeah. I was like, is your back sore? And he was like, nope. And I gave him a big hug. I was like, oh, I'm so happy for you. Like, great job. You know, and it was from squatting like 135 pounds, but it was the first time he'd ever done that. So it was probably refreshing for him to have somebody who was happy about a process thing instead of like nucks for squatting 315 wrong, you know? So whether they can consciously understand that right now, I think as far as breaking them of that habit or changing it, I just be who I naturally am, and I praise hard work, and they know. Then there's also kind of a joke of like, they don't get a compliment from me easily. And so just like about a week ago, some guy was in the weight room and I said, you know what? I said, you have probably the best intent on the team when you do your deadlifts. Like you're so locked in and focused on every rep, no matter how much weight is on the bar. And he looked at me and he goes, guys, I just got a compliment from Rachel. Like I don't hand them out easily. And I think maybe at first they probably are like, what's wrong with this chick? Like I just lifted a lot of weight. Why is she not happy or whatever? And they realize that I'm more happy about like their intent, their consistency, their discipline. And I'm going to praise that. And they're going to have to earn it. They're going to have to earn that praise over a long period of time than just, oh, I'm really strong and I squatted a lot of weight, or I'm really fast and I just ran a fast time on my 40. Like, I'm not going to praise that.
Right.
So I just, you asked the original question that I just went off on a tangent about was how do I break that? And it's just like, I just be myself. And I think over time, at first they might perceive it as me being, you know, never giving a compliment, but over time they probably perceive those compliments as being more like more potent and valuable to them. And they probably, you know, will realize that over time.
I think I had a little bit of an aha moment as you were saying that, in that the best way to teach someone how to do something is to praise them for what you want them to do, right? Mm-hmm. Like when a D does something, like when we're working on being a different way for one another, mm-hmm. and I see her like taking steps in that direction and doing what I want her to do, mm-hmm. I intentionally praise the shit out of it.
Yeah.
And it immediately reinforces that. So by you praising something different, praising the process, yes. praising them doing things with intent, it reinforces like everybody likes yes. to be praised. Yeah.
They're automatically going to, not automatically for everyone, but over time, again, like I think the perception of me up front is that I'm very like cold or I don't give a lot of compliments or whatever, but it's probably because they've been praised or someone has like, ooh, you're so fast, you know? And that's like the anti, if you read Dweck's mindset, it's like the perfect way to create a, you know, a mindset that is indicative of like a non-growth mindset, mm-hmm. is, you know, to praise somebody's natural talent. And so I work with a lot of athletes who are at times naturally talented, who are extremely fast, or they throw a ball really hard or whatever. And then what do? They come in the dugout and someone's like, wow, you just hit 100 miles an hour on the radar. Like, yeah, duh. But he doesn't know how
to try to do that.
Yeah. Like, duh. Why are you going to praise that? Like, why don't you praise something that they worked hard for? So I think it's just, you know, like you said, it's natural then that if you praise something, someone's going to want to do more of it. Hopefully.
Love it. So you already started to define this a little bit, but what's your definition of a good coach and what separates a good coach from a great coach? And you don't have to be comprehensive here, but what are some of the biggest things that you focus on as a coach?
That's to define it in one sentence is not possible, but I would say high standards that you don't deviate from at all costs. And that means, I think one of the hardest things as a coach or a mentor, parent, is if you're going to hold someone to high standards, likely they're not going to like it. And great, if you're working with the most elite athlete in the world, they might immediately recognize that and be like, hey, thank you. You know, like, thank you for holding me to that high standard. Maybe they'll recognize it immediately. But most of the time, they're not going to recognize that. And they're going to think you're being mean about it. And it's going to take them 10 years. Or like, if you're a parent, it takes 20 years for your kid to turn around, or 25 or 30 for your kid to turn around and go, hey, thanks, parents, for being really hard on me. You know, so upfront, it's almost like if you are a coach who truly holds people to high standards, most of the time they're going to hate you, I would say. So I would say that's one of the things that separates coaches or parents, mentors, whatever, is somebody who says that's not good enough. Even when everyone else around them is saying that's good enough, or hey, great job throwing 100 miles an hour. You know, that's really difficult to do.
So that is so good. What do you do though? If they let's say, for instance, you want all of the guys to show up at 6 a.m. every single morning for weights, right? And they come in at 6:10 every single day, but you have this value that you want to set high expectations for them. What I see is most people will, that'll wear on coaches, and somewhere along the way they will deviate and they'll just say fuck it. Right? These guys mm-hmm. aren't going to listen. What do you do?
Well, it depends on like what type of athlete you're working with. And so if you would have asked me last year, like there would be a punishment for that because I think even more so in this day and age, because I'm so old, That's becoming viewed as like, well, you're not a good coach if you can't, you know. But at the same time, you have to think about like where are these guys at on their maturity and their development level. Like if I'm working with a 16-year-old kid from the Dominican Republic who has not had probably a good family structure, has never had any real consequences, you know, for showing up late or not following rules or whatever, you have to teach them a structure. And so while obviously consequences, you know, don't work for everyone, especially when you're an older guy, like if I'm going to punish you, you know, that probably doesn't work. But if your athlete's working off a very low maturity level, and that's not a negative thing, that's just a part of development, they are strictly working off of reward and punishment. Mm-hmm. And that is that's been researched, right? Rewards, punishments, that works for kids. If your kid doesn't eat their vegetables, what do? You punish them. Like you teach them like this is the way. And then later on, they'll be thankful that they ate their vegetables. So same thing. If they're late by 10 minutes, there's a punishment. Whether it's, you know, if it's a physical punishment of running or doing push-ups or whatever, or if it's, you know, they miss out on playing that day or whatever, there should be a punishment to do that. If you're working with older guys who, you know, like I'm working with right now, honestly, I repeat myself 30 times mm-hmm. if I need to. And I put my hand on their shoulder and I'm like, I'll ask them, like, I've asked you to do this. Why haven't you done it? And I make them like be accountable for the why. And it doesn't always work, you know, and you have to be in a structure that supports whatever you're asking them to do. So at times I'll lose that. If I want them to do something and I repeat it 15 times and I go to my superior or whoever is appropriate to say that to, like, hey, I've asked this 15 times and this hasn't happened. And they say, well, it's not going to happen because this guy is this guy or because we need him to play or whatever, then it's not going to happen.
Right.
I feel like that's extremely unfortunate. And that's not necessarily how I would run a business. But there are times when I just have to give way to it, you know. But I think overall for the group of guys that I've worked with this season is that I continue to ask as nicely as possible. And usually if I approach it that way, they'll make the change.
Right.
You know,
I love that too. I was talking to a friend yesterday about this, where when we see a better way for someone to behave to get in order to get better results, right? We see something that they could do better for themselves, not just for us. It's really frustrating when they don't take our advice.
Yeah.
It's like you want to do this.
Yeah.
And me as well as this guy, like we've had the experience of sometimes wanting to like give up on that person, right? Because it's so frustrating and it takes so much energy and we're just like, why won't you do this?
Yeah.
And what's really been really helpful to me is realizing that there was a time in my life where I was that person and I needed a coach to tell me a dozen times, 50 times. I needed them to tell me whatever it was every single time I saw them, because I wasn't in a place where I was ready to really hear that. And it was those people that really stuck to it and stuck with me and said it over and over and over that had that big impact on me. And they didn't give up after just a few times.
Yeah. Oh, that is like, I just related to what you just said so much, because I have given up one time this year. And like my version of giving up is probably even different than other people's. Like when I say give up, it just means that I didn't push as hard, but I didn't not talk to the, you know, not mm-hmm, talk to the mm-hmm. person. But I think the important part of, I just have to realize there are times when I'm like, all right, Rachel, he's not going to do what you want this year, but he's going to remember this. Like later down the road, he's going to remember this, because ultimately, especially with some of the guys that we work with that, again, are coming from really diverse backgrounds from third world countries and just like have had no parenting and just not a lot of people who have held them to anything. And then they come to me and I'm like, hey, I'm going to hold you to everything. That's like they perceive me as just being mean. And so I'm like, all right, they're going to remember you in the future as somebody who actually helped them instead of somebody who looked at them and was like, that's too much work, or I don't understand that person or whatever. And that does happen a lot, unfortunately, with our Latin American players in baseball, because just for a lot of reasons, but people don't either don't want to learn Spanish to communicate with them or haven't spent a lot of time in the Dominican or whatever. And that's something that I really dove into immediately when I got into baseball. And so it's almost a passion of mine to kind of like work with those kids that are difficult to work with, mm-hmm. you know?
So you're a huge proponent of hard work, both personally and professionally. At what point do you think it becomes like the work harder mentality can become a hindrance to working smarter? Because sometimes I feel like the just work more can make people overlook ways of doing things more efficiently and doing like less with kind of the less is more approach.
I mean, I've definitely been like on that end of the scale where I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna work hard I'm gonna show up 2 hours early just to make sure that everyone knows that I work hard. I've definitely made that mistake, but I will say that I'm glad to be on that end of the spectrum. Because when I need to work hard, I can. When I need, like, you're like seeing me in a state of like absolute murderous work right now where I'm working 80 hours a week plus, and we just had a 13-hour bus ride yesterday back from Springfield, Missouri. And when we got off the bus, everyone went home and went to sleep at, you know, 6:30 or 7, whatever we got in. And I went to Starbucks and was studying because I don't have a choice. Like, I don't view myself as having a choice right now. So I'm glad that that was instilled in me, because when I need to, or when I have to, or when I want to, I can easily tap into that crazy, ridiculous work ethic. I don't know how my parents did this, but I also take a month long trip to Asia, mm-hmm. and I can like switch out of that and like realize that I need space to, you know, to digest like those times of ridiculous work. So when does it become, if you're doing it for someone else, like if you're doing it just so other people can see you work hard, that's counterproductive. Mm-hmm. If there is a more efficient way and you're not taking it and you know it, that's counterproductive. If you can't switch it off, I'm talking to you, Jocko. I'm talking to you. Yes. Talking to you, Goggins. No, if you can't switch it off and it's like an addictive thing and you're just doing it because you're addicted to it, then that's probably counterproductive. But I think that we're not we don't have a problem of there's just too many people who work too hard. I don't think that's the case. I think a lot of people could not last 7 days doing what I'm doing right now, which is I'm taking online master's classes and I'm training close to 2 hours a day, and I'm working this crazy job that I don't have any time off from. Like they couldn't do it.
Right. I would agree with that too. That we don't have a shortage of,
I know where you're
just
going.
It's not very common. Yeah. The work too hard. I think just to add to what you're saying, when there's no time for reflection on why we're doing what we're doing and how we're doing what we're doing, then that's working hard for work's sake, right? Yeah. When it's just we're on autopilot and we're just going through the motions and we're not checking in on the why and the how we're going about things, because I think those things are incredibly important for us to remember and for us to be intentional about how we're doing things, mm-hmm. right? So we can constantly upgrade and refine our methods.
Yeah. Like that's a great point. It's just, if you're not aware of why or like going into this season, I was like, okay, I have to take physics, calculus, and a software program online by myself, and I have to work this crazy job of baseball, and I refuse to let my fitness go. Like my goal was like, I'm going to remain healthy, and not just healthy but super strong, and I'm doing this this gymnastics program that's like taxing, so this is gonna suck. Like I went into it and I was like, all right, this is a time where I'm gonna bury my head in the sand, I'm just gonna do it, and then I'm gonna, you know, go to Asia for a month or whatever. Like I'm aware of it. I know why I'm doing it. There's a purpose behind it. And, you know, it just, it is what it is. But a lot of people, even from a training perspective, I was just telling you this last night, is people think they're working hard in the gym. And I'm like, you're at 75% of your capacity. And they're like, no, I can't do anymore. And I'm like, I'm telling you, you can, mm-hmm. but they've never pushed themselves to that ridiculous, like, threshold where, you know, they just can't go anymore.
Right.
Physically or mentally, you know?
Right. Yeah. You bring up another good point as well, with just the way that you live. You go through intense periods of effort, like just very high intensity. And then you have periods of intense rest.
Yeah.
And what I've learned from about strength and conditioning, about energy preservation, about productivity, is that's the absolute best way to do it. Go as hard as you can for some interval and then have some period of rest. And so then we're able to operate at actually 100%. Mm-hmm. And then we're able to completely rest and rejuvenate. And when, you know, when I was training for the games, one of the things that our coach drilled into us is stay out of the gray zone, stay out of the gray zone, stay out of the place where you're going like pretty hard, but not really hard. And what a lot of athletes do, especially CrossFitters, because I think it's a, I don't know why it happens in CrossFit, but it's just like a very like volume intensive sport. A lot of people, that's where they live all year long, is just that moderate 80% intensity. Mm-hmm. And they think they're trying as hard as they can, but they couldn't possibly be going at 100% because they haven't taken a rest day in 2 weeks, right?
Yeah,
we need that intense, full rest and rejuvenation.
Yeah, that's a great, like, that's an excellent metaphor for life. Just stay out of the gray zone. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever you're doing, be a 10 out of 10 at what you're doing. And so that means be a 10 out of 10 of your rest and relaxation too. Like, when I take my break, I go to New Zealand. You know, I don't like chill and go to like happy hours in the local whatever. Like, I don't want to have like a, I don't want to have a gray rest and relaxation. Mm-hmm. I want to just have it to the max.
Right.
So yeah, I'm definitely on that wavelength. Like, stay out of the gray zone. Don't be vanilla.
Yeah.
Don't be basic. You know, be the best at whatever you're doing.
And if you want to go to happy hour, that's okay. She's not talking shit on happy hour.
But go to happy hour
in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah. Go to happy hour in New Zealand. Absolutely. Like, I was telling Mike last night, I was telling you, like, if I'm going to party, which I like, I never do. Like, I told you last night, like, I've probably had alcohol 3 times in 2018. And one of those was I went out on New Year's with my sisters in Bangkok, in Thailand. Like, okay, this is how we're going to do this. And it's only one way of like, all right, it's I'm obviously like all or nothing.
Right.
You know? Yes. Literally.
You're like, I think we had a good time, but I can't quite remember.
Yeah. Like, but to me, I'm like, who wants to go out and have a couple beers after the game at like some dumpy like local bar, which I'm sure, like, okay, great for you if that's how you want to do it. But I'm like, I'm not going to waste alcohol on a couple beers in a dumpy town. Like, let's just go to Thailand and do it right.
This is taking an interesting turn.
Yeah.
Go all over Asia, all over the East, guys. I heard this concept of minimally supporting others recently. And the guy said, do as little for others as possible so that they can do it for themselves. How does that resonate with how you coach?
Like, everything you just said, I love it. Minimally supporting others. So counterintuitive. I just put out something like on social media. I don't know what I said, but it was something along the lines of like this whole... this is going to offend people or someone's going to not like this, but like servant leadership and we need to serve the athletes and you have to go to them and, you know, and I just, it rubs me the wrong way and I know what they're saying, but like serving the athletes can so quickly become just babying them. And it, I see it so much that I'm like almost to the opposite end of that. Like I stop myself from loading weights on a bar, or like we use a lot of technology. And with the Astros, I don't think that's I'm not sharing trade secrets. Like we're really progressive with technology. Yeah. And like at the very beginning of the year, I was like, we have to teach these guys how to use this software, because I am not going to sit here with this iPad in the weight room and like, you know, set it up for them, enter their weight on it. Da, 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 da. Like I taught them right away. I put it in their hands, and there was some like, there were some guys that were like, can you just do it for me? And I was like, no, you do it. Like you're a smart person. Even with our Latin players, because a lot of them were like, you know, it's just a little bit slower learning curve. Like their information retention and critical thinking is a little slower with them because of their education in the in those gotcha. Countries. And so it takes them longer. And they get frustrated and they see other guys who they're learning it faster. And they're like, can you just do it for me? And I'm like, no, if this takes me 10 times, you're going to do it yourself. And that's just a small example of like, no, you record your times. You load. They'll ask me all the time, how much weight's on the bar right now? I'm like, I don't know. Count it.
I like that.
Like, I'm like not going to count the weights.
I've never caught that.
It's like the simplest things. Like, they don't probably hate me. They hate me for sure. Like, they think I'm mean, because along their process, probably a lot of people have done the software for them, told them how much weight's on the bar, told, you know, not taught them processes. Like I will teach them formulas for power. I'll teach them periodization. Like I want them to really own it, and they cannot, it's impossible to own it if you're supporting them, holding their hand every step of the way. Mm-hmm.
So why is it important to that they do it for themselves?
Well, because they're men, they're grown people, or they should be.
Let's
you know?
Take something not just loading their weights. Why is it, you know, maybe it's their, I can't even think of another example.
I think the easy answer to what you just said is like, well, for me personally, and for our setting is we don't have them in the off season. And so it's like, who's going to count your weights for you in the off season? Mm-hmm. Are you going to enter? We use Team Builder. Like, are you going to enter your weights in Team Builder? How are you going to do that if you count the freaking weights on the bar? You're not doing it efficiently and correctly. So that's like the easy answer. But for me, it's again, just creating an environment where what I'm telling them is count the weights on the bar. But what I'm really telling them is you're intelligent, you're self-sufficient, you're a grown up, you're mature. And I'm telling them that by allowing them, I'm not even going to say making them do it. Mm-hmm. I'm allowing them to do it by themselves. Mm-hmm.
Really allowing them to take responsibility for yes. themselves. And that just automatically transfers over to other areas of their life.
Yes. Like a human. It's not just important. Of course, like, okay, it's important for them to be able to do it on their own in the off season when I'm not with them, but it's important as a human being. Like, what are you telling your student, your athlete, your daughter, son, whatever, when you're doing everything for them, you're mm-hmm. telling them through your actions, you can't do it. You're not able to do it. You're not smart enough to do it. You're not good enough. Whatever it is, you're telling them they're not able. And so by your actions, you're saying, no, just figure it out.
Right.
And maybe you'll fail. Ooh.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, scary.
Yeah, right.
You know?
So I heard this other, I just remembered this other little piece of what this guy was saying. As a coach, whenever we do if we tell them everything they need to do, and like we teach them the lesson and don't give them the chance to learn it for themselves, then we get the credit. We get that feeling of a win rather than them. And so it's kind of a selfish, it's a selfish thing to do it for them sometimes, mm-hmm. because then we get to be the recipient of mm-hmm. this reward, which is like,
thank you.
You know, feeling like we did something right.
Yeah.
Rather than giving that to them.
Yeah. Who is this person? Like I need to,
Eben Pagan.
I need to be friends with him. Yeah, absolutely. It's a, you know, just like serving. I mean, no good deed is like for, I forget, like what's the phrase, like you're, no good deed is actually for that other person. Mm-hmm. And like 100% me going to Asia to teach English, like that was for me,
right?
why did I even think that? Like, that was for me, that whole experience had nothing to do with those kids, you know? It did, but it didn't, you know what right. I'm saying? So same thing is like, we want to serve the athletes because then it makes us feel good about ourselves. But like, no, I want the athletes to be self-sufficient and to feel empowered and to feel mature and to feel like they almost don't need me mm-hmm. at the end of it, you know, when we're done with the teaching that's happened, that they understand bar speed, they know what weight to put on the bar, they understand why, they understand periodization, they understand rest, they understand these concepts so that they're self-sufficient. Like, isn't that so much more like you said, rewarding for them than if I give it to them, right. you know? But that's so, so counterintuitive to a lot of people's coaching styles.
Right. Well, a lot of people's coaching styles is very insecure, and they want their athletes to be dependent on them. Right?
100%.
Leaders in general, a lot of leaders want the people under them to be dependent on them, right? When someone leaves a company, a lot of times, they hope that the company like fails without them. So that mm-hmm. affirms their worth in the company.
Yeah.
I think it was in the book, Good to Great. One of the marks of the 13 great, some of the greatest companies in the United States. One of the marks was that when the CEO left,
yes, yeah.
the company got more successful.
I remember
because
that.
Of what they imparted on them.
Yeah.
And I think it's something I just learned recently is like, sometimes we don't like we try to protect ourselves and don't like praise others or don't build others up, but because that would make us smaller mm-hmm. by building them up. But what really happens, and this really resonated with me when she said this, what really happens is like we're even bigger at that point. If we have the strength to build someone else up, that makes us into something even bigger. And that, yeah. I don't know, that really landed with me.
That's just like a coach who, I mean, that's it from Coach Hatch, like we were talking about last mm-hmm. night, like Coach Hatch is so great. I think people look at him as a great coach because of the giant tree of coaches mm-hmm. that has come after him. And it doesn't make him any worse that he's no longer coaching or whatever, because he's living on in people that he's inspired and mentored and coached, you know, that are going on to greatness themselves. It's just, you know, that is leadership.
Right.
That's mentorship.
So let's talk about a performance pyramid for a second. So the bottom of the pyramid is things like sleep and nutrition and focusing on technique. And then top of the pyramid stuff is, I don't know, the newest gadget or supplementation, right? Things that have a much smaller effect. Do you feel pressure either internally or externally to look for the top of the pyramid things, like the new cutting edge stuff? And if so, how do you, how do you navigate being a coach and making sure that you're focusing on what's going to make the biggest impact on people?
That's not that hard for me, I don't think, because I don't know, it goes back to being process oriented, you know. There is a little bit of like, from a psyche perspective, giving the athletes a little bit of what they want and all of what they need. Like, so we might do some fancy plyometrics or whatever before they're ready or before they even need it, I would say. I'll put those in there so that they can like have some enjoyment, or especially if I've got a guy who we are like focusing on technique and he sees everyone else doing something else, like from a team perspective, I'm like, okay, he'll do some of that still, but this particular point, we're going to only squat 135 pounds, but then you can do some of this, you know, like air quotes, sexy stuff that everybody else is doing. Not because he sits in a corner and is like, why can't I do it? You know, these guys are a little bit older, but just from a team dynamic, I don't want to completely remove that guy from what everyone else is doing. So, I mean, it's not that hard for me because I am so process oriented. Like, you cannot be squatting double your body weight if your back hurts every time and your knees are collapsing in. So let's go back because we missed something on the basic level. And so that's, again, from mentors of, you know, at LSU, I think my mentorship was much more like cultural and like, you know, meathead, which I don't think anyone would be mad about if they heard this podcast. Super like meathead, just crank up the music, throw on the weight, da da da.
Ryan Fowler would be pissed right now.
Oh, he is so mad. That was like super meathead culture, like do whatever necessary. And then also I was mentored by Athletes Performance, which is like super functional, corrective exercise, movement. My mentor, Chris Frankel, very like movement-based biomechanics. And so I've got a really unique blend where if I see someone has met the bottom pyramid, great, let's crank up the music and throw on some weight and put on the gym wear and like see how fast we can move it and be meatheads. But if I see someone who hasn't met that bottom tier, there's no qualms about me stripping down the weight and going to body weight and talking about the arch in their feet and the, you know, just like really minuscule things and getting them like a bunion corrector to correct their big toe. And, you know, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's probably a good thing, but like, that's, you know, there's
look
no problem
either way.
Look what
I've got on the desk there. You see that plastic? What? It's bunion spacers.
Yeah. Okay, great. Good. So we're on the same page. Yeah. So it's like, I don't have a problem with either one. Like I can go to one end of the spectrum or the other very easily. And I like, it's fine. I can coach both ways in the same weight room with the same group of people. There'll right. be different, you know, guys on ends of different ends of the spectrum who are using the fancy stuff and some guys who are doing the very basic.
Right. What's something that has changed about your coaching methods over the past year?
I'd say patience, probably. Just like kind of what I talked about earlier is, you know, in previous years working with a lot of the younger athletes, it's like, okay, you didn't show up on time, here's your punishment, very cut and dry, clean. With these guys, it's you didn't show up on time, let me take a big, huge, deep breath, calm myself and say, hey, we discussed 6 a.m., which never happens. We discussed 2 p.m., you're here at 2:03 and waiting for the response, which at first the response was like, yeah, 2:03, no big deal.
That's on time.
Yeah. And so then I'm like, okay, you've never ever heard this before, or you've never been held to this before. When I say 2 p.m., you're late at 2 p.m. So please come in early, air quotes in your mind, to be here on time in the way. Cause like a new thing for these guys this year was we start on time as a group and we have like a discussion of this is what phase we're in, or this is the focus, or we talk about recovery. We have like a basically a whiteboard session, mm-hmm. which I think is something that's been new to them this year. And so they kind of just used to kind of come in on their own, start on their own time. And I'm just like, the group's starting at 2. And if you're not here at 2, I'm mad. Mm-hmm. And that's new to them. So patience, I guess, is something I've learned.
Yeah. And it sounds like, well, this isn't something you changed, but again, there's just so much accountability. Like you're demanding that they be accountable for themselves.
Yeah.
Which is one of the most powerful things I think a teacher can teach a student.
Yeah. Yep.
So I've got a few personal questions for you and then we'll get out of here. What's the number one thing you've done for your personal development over the past year?
I have I've already talked about like going to Asia and traveling and being out of my comfort zone. So I think something that's been really potent is my relationship. Like first time in my life that I've allowed myself to be extremely intentional about my relationship, which is with my boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And I put work, like I work on that as hard as I work on the other areas of my life, which is the first time that's ever happened. I think that's a combination of like a desire to do so, but that desire is based off of probably I feel like my feet are on the ground in my career. And so now that I've filled that requirement, which is something that's very important to me, I'm like, okay, now I can put intention, the intention that it deserves, you know, mm-hmm. I can put attention to a relationship. So I think that's definitely been a huge thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I noticed that. So I asked what was the biggest personal development and you talked about a relationship, mm-hmm. which I don't argue with. I think that is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. What's been the impact on you personally putting intention into a relationship?
Vulnerability, you know, like really allowing someone to see me vulnerable. Yeah. And then like those two go hand in hand, like mm-hmm. allowing myself to be vulnerable around somebody and then have somebody else see me like totally exposed mm-hmm. Has taught me a lot about myself. You know, I think, again, the relationship is for the relationship, but it's also for you. Like you totally. Get to uncover so many things about yourself through, you know, working with somebody else basically. And again, like letting them see you completely naked, like, the, you know, I,
metaphorically and
literally and figuratively speaking, just like completely out there, you know, crying or angry or struggle or whatever. And that's for you too, you know?
So 100%. Like when I get to share something with a D that I've never told anyone before, that's just mm-hmm. been this like tiny little thing festering in my brain for all these years. And I get to finally let it out.
Yeah.
And then for her to say, okay, thank you for sharing. And I still love you. It creates so much more freedom and like both in my body, in my mind, and it allows me to love me more.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's something so big in that.
Yeah. That's, I have so much more to give in that area. Like mm-hmm. I have so much more growth to happen in that area, but yeah, that's exactly right.
Very cool. Another analogy that I love is a friend of ours, Annie, taught us that we basically, like in an intimate relationship, we're basically hiring the other person to be kind of like the crucible for us becoming the best versions of ourselves.
Yeah.
Like the Ooh. Crucible by which we sharpen ourselves. So if we're in a co-committed relationship versus a codependent, right? One where we are holding each other to the highest standard that we know the other can live up to, and we're holding each other to what we say we want. Where was I going with this?
I don't know, but it's pretty good.
Keep going. We're gonna, you know, like, I know what Adi is capable of. I know what she's going for. I know who she wants to be. And when I see her acting small and not living up to that, then I can just say, hey, I see you doing this. You said you wanted that. And we constantly do that with one another. So we're constantly being that accountability partner, that tool sharpening ourselves, right?
I'm laughing because that's exactly like it's so painful sometimes, but that's exactly what my boyfriend and I do for each other. Is like, I mean, he'll call me on my bullshit so fast. Mm-hmm. It is incredible. Like he has no mercy. Like he's just like, and that's why I love him. That's why it's so great, is because he's probably the first person that's ever like really done that for me mm-hmm. in a relationship where I'll be upset about something. And he's like, this is your fault. Like this is all your fault. I saw this coming. Right, you saw this coming, and you can't complain about it. Wow. Like he's so upfront about stuff. So that's why I'm laughing about that.
Well, it's coming full circle too. Cause earlier you were talking about as a coach, yes. you set high standards, yes. right? So it's very similar. Like we appreciate that so much because we know, okay, on this person's watch, I can't yep. be anything less than what I'm capable of.
Yes. You're right. You're exactly right. Like just like I said earlier, like I've, you know, gravitated towards mentors that have been like my parents, and now a boyfriend who's like those mentors who like I'm demanding of people, and I want people around me who are just as demanding of me. Friends, a boyfriend, whatever. Like I can't have a person in my life who's not gonna, you know, be in a co-committed relationship where they're holding me to the highest standard of like of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what you want, right? Like, exactly. That's what everyone says they want probably, but not everyone's ready for that maybe, you know?
Right. And when they've got it, they don't know they've got it. They just think the person's maybe being an yeah. asshole, or yeah. they're wrong or whatever. Yeah.
So yeah. many parallels between what we're talking about in coaching. We exactly. just, you know, it's exactly right. It's human relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I've got a quote of yours.
Uh-oh.
You don't have to sacrifice femininity to be a fucking savage. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh my gosh. I need to like live up to that quote more. I think, I don't think I know. That's not my quote. I posted it. It's not my quote. Damn. It came from somewhere. I can't remember who I like got it from. Yeah, like this is pretty explicit there. I just believe like I'm a dichotomous person. Like I am super feminine, or I can be, I should say, like very feminine person, but also like can be very like masculine or mm-hmm. alpha, you know? And I, every day I'm like switching in and out of this role, especially because of my job. Like I go to work and I want to share a funny story about something that happened the other day, about like a week or so ago. I was wearing sunglasses on the top of my head in the dugout, and it was at night, like the game's at night. So I was wearing sunglasses on the top of my head, which I do routinely, and I do on purpose because of this. One of the players was like, "Rachel, why are you wearing sunglasses on your head? Like it's nighttime." And I was like, "It's my accessory." And he goes, "Totally kidding." But he goes, he looked at me with like a disgusted look, and he was like, "You know what? You say something really girly like once a month, and it just rubs me the wrong way." And he was kidding. Like he was kidding, but
that's funny.
But it's true. Like at work, I'm just very, you know, just. I don't want to say masculine, but I'm just like,
that's okay though, because we all have both.
Yeah,
it's not male female.
It's masculine, but it's like feminine. I just don't. I'm not a distraction. Right. I wear men's clothing. I've started to wear women's clothing like in the past year to 2 years of my career. I know. I can't believe I'm wearing clothes that fit me. yeah, but I wear like men's t-shirts and just like no makeup. Hair's a freaking absolute mess. Sweating, dirt, like. Routinely I'm like stepping gum, there's like, you know, just a mess, right? Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, like in the same day, I might go home and like my boyfriend and I go to dinner and I'm wearing heels and makeup and mm-hmm. a dress, and I love it. Like I love both sides of that, and I don't think you have to sacrifice one to be the other. In the same breath, I often sacrifice the perception of femininity because I'm worried about what people will think mm-hmm. if I, you know, we were discussing this yesterday, like what people will think if I post a picture of myself looking really, you know, feminine mm-hmm. or in a swimsuit or just being a human,
right.
like being who I am. I don't show that side to the public as mm-hmm. much as I really, you know, as much as I really am. It's not, you know, that's like kind of it's a vulnerable point for me. Like right. I've especially in the past, like when I was first getting into the business, I was so afraid of people perceiving me or like just like seeing how feminine I was, especially at first. I mean, if you look online with pictures of me, my sisters give me so much shit about like what I wore, like getting into the business, I would wear like basketball shorts down to my knees, like giant t-shirts, you know, like the mid socks. Like I just look straight. Like I don't look straight. I look like yeah. I'm gay, you know?
Right.
So, but that was on purpose, and mm-hmm. maybe it served a purpose. And now I'm just coming into a point of my life where I just like, I don't care as much. So I wear women's clothing and people see that I have a waistline and boobs, like, oh, mm-hmm. okay. That's scary. You know, it's right. scary enough. So yeah, that's that.
Well, yeah, thank you for honoring that too, and just being open about that it's something that you're working on, because I know I'm sure there are a lot of people that will listen to this that have either experienced or are currently experiencing it. So just seeing someone badass like yourself also struggles, and
it's really hard,
is a constant work in progress, is I think really helpful.
I want to own that more, you know, but and we kind of discussed too before this podcast, is it's valid that I'm afraid of those things, because I've had really negative experiences mm-hmm. with people making comments or just like comments about my social media, or if I do put something out there, or even like what I wore at the conference this year. And, you know, I hear the comments that are said, and that's only what I hear. So I'm sure there's plenty of other talk going around. And so it's a hard battle in my mind of like, am I, especially from like just from a social media perspective, who's my audience? Do I really care about like the, you know, colleagues or other like acquaintances that are making fun of that and that are using it in a wrong way against me? Or am I sending my message out to young women who I want to empower? And that's what I really want to do. So if that's what I really want to do, I have to ignore the bad stuff that might come from that.
Mm-hmm. Or acknowledge and kind of let it go, right?
Yes.
Maybe let go of the need to control their perceptions, right?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Cool. Rachel, this was awesome. Where can people keep up with you?
Probably I'm on Instagram the most. I've kind of like let Facebook go, and I'm not on Twitter very much, but a little bit. So I would say Instagram, it's rachel.balkovec. And
B-A-L-K-O-V-E-C.
Ooh, good job.
I got you.
That's pretty good. Yeah. There. And I mean, I have a website that I haven't been keeping up with much lately, but I will be soon.
One blog post a year.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm coming up on a time where I'm coming out of my like ridiculous head in the sand moment. Mm-hmm. So when I move on to my next phase for school, I think I'll have a little bit more time to kind of keep up with that stuff. So rachelbalkovec.com and on Instagram, rachel.balkovec.
Hell yeah. And you can follow me at Michael Cazioux, C-A-Z-A-Y-O-U-X. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.